Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you. It's now my privilege to introduce to us Dr. Daniela F. Seif. Her speech is Trauma Worlds and Their Transformation, Moving Beyond a Life Built Around Fear, Dissociation, and Shame. Dr. Daniela is an author, scholar, and speaker. She is deeply curious about what shapes us as human beings. She began her quest for understanding at the University of Oxford, receiving her doctorate in biological anthropology by way of researching traditional cattle herding people in the wilderness of Tanzania. The people were called the Datoga. Her curiosity about what shapes us later shifted to emotional trauma and how we can reshape ourselves. Her research brings her personal experience into concert with concepts found in depth psychology, anthropology, and evolution. She's the author of Understanding and Healing Emotional Trauma, Conversations with Pioneering Clinicians and Researchers. And we will now begin her talk, Trauma Worlds and Their Transformation.
Thank you, Ricky. I can see that there is someone called Daniela Seif in the participants. So shall we see if she's actually been able to make it? So Daniela, let me try and bring you in. Okay. Daniela, can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm in a lay-by on my mobile phone in a kind of, you know, in the middle of a lane.
All right. So would you like us to play the video for you? And then if people have questions, they can put them in the chat and you can answer them live.
Yes, I think that's the best idea. I think this is just going to be a nightmare trying to do it here on this phone.
All right, let's do that then. Daniela, thank you for being with us today. This is great news despite all of these challenges. Perfect. So do put your questions either in the chat or in the queue. Better in the chat this time around. And then Daniela can respond to them as we go along. Thank you so much. Then I guess we can switch our videos off and then play the video with Daniela. Thank you.
It's great to have the opportunity to be part of this amazing conference, to be able to talk about trauma worlds and their transformation alongside all these other amazing speakers. The way that I'm going to structure this talk is in the first half, I'm going to talk about trauma and trauma worlds. And in the second half, I'm going to talk about their healing, their transformation, and about trusted worlds. Everyone's at a different place with their inner work. We're all focusing on different things. So different bits of this talk will speak to different people. My suggestion to get the most from this is to notice what's happening in your body, to notice when you feel seen or hopeful or curious, to notice when you feel a bit uncomfortable, to notice what images and memories come up for you. I'm going to start by defining trauma. And that's because trauma is really quite complex and it can be looked at from many different angles. And although all those angles are really valuable, it's good to have a sense of what angle the presenter comes from when you're listening to somebody. So my background is in academic anthropology. I've spent 20 years researching trauma, written a book of interviewing some leaders in the field. And I've also been working with my own personal experience for over 20 years. So I bring those three strands together in how I address trauma and define it. Popular culture defines trauma as being a victim of harm, and it sees trauma as lying in those harmful experiences themselves, in the abuse, in the neglect, in the loss, in the fear, in the terror. I don't think that's the best or the most helpful way to define trauma. And the reason for that is that the impact of any one event can be very different on different people, depending on a whole host of different factors. So one of the factors that's very important in whether an event instigates trauma or not is what happens after that event, how it's looked after. And to give a brief example, let me use a physical analogy. I've had two bad tears in my body in my life. I've completely ruptured my Achilles tendon in my ankle, and I've also ruptured my anterior cruciate ligament in my knee. The Achilles tendon was potentially a much worse injury in that had it not been picked up and had it not been treated, I'd have always walked with a limp, I'd have never run again. But the Achilles was picked up and noticed pretty soon after it was happened. I had the operation. Yes, I was very limited in my movement for 6 months, but that was years ago, and the long-term impact on my life has been absolutely minimal. In contrast, my anterior cruciate ligament wasn't picked up at the time. I think it happened when I was in my late teens and I just thought I'd torn a muscle, but I don't know because it wasn't picked up. And I kind of got on with life and ran a half marathon and did quite a lot of stuff with no anterior cruciate ligament. But what happened was that my body'd had to slightly twist itself out of shape. I kept locking my knee because it wasn't stable. And by the time I was in my mid-40s, the knock-on effects were chronic back pain that was such that it took me like 10 minutes in the morning to get my shoes and socks on. So, and you know, my anterior cruciate will never heal now, and I have to look after it because it has a long-term impact, an enduring impact on my life. Emotional trauma is similar, so I define it as alterations in who we are in response to unhealed emotional wounds. So what is it about unhealed emotional wounds? Well, our internal system, our mind, our internal body has to compensate, has to shift its position in order to cope with those areas that have been broken, that have been injured. And also it creates defense systems which are aimed at trying to prevent similar injuries ever happening again. We don't make a conscious decision to switch on these internal systems. In fact, we're often unaware that they've been activated, but it's just what human brains and bodies do in the face of unhealed emotional wounds. And these systems are necessary, they're important, they get us through, but they carry a heavy price. They alter the biology of our brains and our bodies. They alter how our feelings are expressed and how we relate to our feelings. They alter how we perceive ourselves, how we perceive other people. They change our internal voices, how we think, how we behave. Ultimately, they compromise and distort our relationship with ourselves, and as a knock-on effect of that, our relationship with other people. Our inner world has changed. We're living in a new inner normality. I call this inner world, this new inner world, a trauma world. And it was kind of difficult to explain what I meant by a new inner world before COVID came up, but it was hard to kind of get a feeling. But COVID offers us a very kind of good example of it. So we were living in normality and whatever way was normal to us, not questioning it. That's just how life was. And then COVID emerged and all these restrictions came and there was fear. We'd go to a supermarket, somebody who wasn't wearing a mask would cough and we'd wonder if we were now going to die. Or we'd pick up a newspaper. touch our hands by mistake and wonder if we'd now given ourselves COVID. So there was a whole change in our normality, this new normal, and it's the same. We get a parallel change with unhealed emotional wounds, only this new normality is internal. This trauma world changes, it's internal. And unlike what's happened with COVID, we can't step in and out of it. It's so interwoven with the fibres of our neurosystem, our hormonal system, that it becomes part of who we are. Each person's trauma world is going to be different depending on their personality, their experiences, their environment, and indeed their culture. But I think with all trauma worlds, our relationship with ourselves is going to be founded on three qualities. One is an increased level of fear, a vigilance, a hypervigilance. The second is dissociation, and the third is toxic shame. I'm now going to talk about each quality in turn. I'll present them one at a time because that's how talks work. That's how language work. That's not how this process works. That's not really how trauma worlds work. In trauma worlds, fear, dissociation and shame work as a triple helix, as this kind of negative spiral that takes us down and down. They interweave with one another. I'll begin by talking with fear because it really is so fundamental. Fear comes in at first with the original traumatizing events. We'll be in pain because of whatever's happened to us, but we're also going to be frightened. So it's there right at the start. And then, really potently, is a fear of re-traumatization. We know how painful whatever it was is. We're determined that it's never going to happen to us again. That terror, that determination is often held unconsciously. And because fear is such a kind of visceral experience, it's quite hard to think about unconscious fear. But a good way to think about it is to think about how we cross roads or walking along pavements. You know, when we're in a city, we'll keep to the pavement. We're not going to step out onto the road until we're at traffic lights, till we're at a pedestrian crossing. And it's fear that's keeping us on the pavement. Fear of being run over, fear of being hit by a car. But we're not conscious of that fear. We're not aware of it. It's just, it is shaping and determining our behaviour. With emotional trauma, when we've got emotional wounds, we get the same kind of fear that's going to stop us effectively stepping off an emotional pavement, stepping into new worlds. But then there'll be whole areas of our life that we're not going to enter, where we won't step off, where we won't cross the road. And effectively, our lives become narrower, dulled, areas of our potential are cut off. It also, when we do that, when we start avoiding areas, we actually can start creating the very problems that we're most desperately trying to avoid. So to give you an example, there was a study done, a recent study by psychologists of kids whose parents were very critical. And what these psychologists found by observing the kids really closely was that they just avoided looking at their parents' faces. They weren't conscious that they were doing this. There was no decision to avoid looking at faces. But because they met criticism whenever they looked up, they didn't. They just had unconsciously got into the habit of not looking at their faces. It was protective. It helped protect them from the pain, the fear of meeting criticism in their parents' faces. But it had a lot, you know, it would have terrible side effects because these kids would also miss positive, encouraging looks from their parents or from other people. And once we stop looking at faces as a kind of, you know, unconscious but kind of orientation, we're not going to see the kind of social signals that people give off. We use facial expressions to understand what people's emotions are and to navigate our way in that social world. And if we're not looking at faces, we don't pick up those cues. So we're not going to be able to respond to the people in our world in a kind of sensitive and appropriate way. And so they are then, more people are going to be critical of us. Becomes this kind of fear-fulfilling prophecy. Even worse, I think we've got this kind of hypervigilance, because we know how frightening and painful this experience was and aren't going to go there again, to see threats where none exist. We're going, you know, something in us is going, there's danger. Again, we're not aware of it, but it's like we've got this overly sensitive smoke alarm written into the cells of our body. You know, with a smoke alarm, if it goes off because we've burnt the toast, we can go, oh, well, the toast is burnt, I'm switching the smoke alarm off. When that smoke alarm is actually inside of us, we get so kind of caught up, it takes over so fast, it's very difficult to switch it off. And so we're going to perceive those threats to be real, we're going to overreact to them. You know, if our wound, original wound, was being abandoned, we might think that somebody's about to abandon us because they've been very busy and they haven't returned a phone call or something, and then either attack them for abandoning us or go all cold or whatever we're going to do, and that's going to make them less likely to want to be around us. So again, another fear-fulfilling prophecy. Disconnection, dissociation is the second element that makes up a trauma world. I actually prefer, as you probably gathered, the word disconnection. And the reason why I prefer it is because dissociation is used quite widely in the realm of trauma, people talking about trauma, but it's used to describe very different things. And so it can be quite confusing. And also disconnection just feels more visceral. It just strikes chords more. It feels kind of more ordinary and more easier to grasp. So disconnection starts with the original traumatizing events. When we're immediately hit by pain and fear, we numb out. So, you know, you hit your finger with a hammer or you fall off a bicycle. Often, the first thing, you're not aware for a few seconds of feeling pain and fear. And the reason for that is that there's a huge release of opiates, because if we're in a dangerous situation, we have to just get up and get on with it. You know, whereas feeling pain and fear incapacitates us. But pain and fear tell us we're in danger. They're important signals. And once we get to safety, we're then going to become conscious of them and aware of them. What happens with emotional trauma and why these wounds turn into trauma is because often we can't get to safety after we're wounded. There's no emotionally safe place for us to take our wounds. And so they remain in this disconnected state, this numb state. We can't let the feelings in. And then we can't repair, then we're on the road to trauma. At this point, we've started to disconnect from our own reality, or not to connect to our own reality. Bits of our experience are annexed in our unconscious. They're held as unconscious memory. They remain part of us. We don't lose them just because we're not aware of them. But we are separated from them. We're split off from them. And as a result, our relationship with ourselves is now really compromised. We're not fully connected to our truth. We're also at this point, once we've not been in a safe environment to let those emotions come to the fore, we develop fear of anything that might just revive those emotions, might awaken them, might trigger them. Because we've got this kind of belief now that we're going to be overwhelmed and unable to cope if they are triggered. We're not going to be able to function, that it's going to make us very vulnerable to being traumatized again, that it's going to be a very dangerous situation to be. And so what this means is we're now driven to avoid both what might re-traumatize us and anything that might trigger the pain and fear from our trauma that we've cut off, that we've disconnected from. Again, it's not conscious, but our lives are narrowed, they're dulled. There's also this depression that starts here, because it takes energy to keep feelings out of awareness. It takes energy to avoid anything that might, you know, reignite those feelings. We're using energy that could be used much more creatively to keep things hidden from ourselves. We also disconnect from aspects of ourselves to protect ourselves from being re-traumatized. So that kind of, we know this is really painful, never again are we going to be vulnerable, leaves us to cutting off whatever aspect of ourself we think might have caused us to be attacked or abandoned or caused that loss in the first place. We might be right. It might have been our curiosity or our need for, you know, help, our vulnerability or our anger that led originally to us being attacked or abandoned. We might be wrong about what we deem, you know, caused those issues in the first place. Doesn't matter. Once we've kind of decided that that's the probable cause, we cut off that part of ourselves. Again, it's not conscious, it happens unconsciously. But we take at that point a further step into self-abandonment, into self-alienation, into a compromised relationship with ourselves. Toxic shame is the third element that makes up a trauma world. Healthy shame is an emotion that comes and goes, like all emotions are supposed to, that passes through us, and that warns us that how we are in this moment is unacceptable, that it risks us losing important relationships in the environment in which we evolve, possibly that it risks us being thrown out of the group. And so it's a warning to tell us to behave differently, to stop doing what we're doing. With toxic shame, however, that state that we're doing something wrong actually kind of transforms into a kind of embodied and unconscious and insidious belief that somehow we are fundamentally wrong in some very kind of critical, core, essential way, enduring way. And that our wrongness makes us unworthy of meaningful relationships, of support, of love, of fulfillment, of success, of contentment. Often also, which is a problem when we're working with our trauma, that we're unworthy of healing. Like other elements in the trauma world, toxic shame is generally held unconsciously in our minds and in our bodies. But it makes itself felt through inner voices that are dismissive, that are belittling, that are hostile, in a sense that we don't belong, that maybe we're an imposter, that with social anxiety. It can be visible in body posture, avoidant eyes is a sign of shame, being hunched down, or being puffed up and trying to make ourselves bigger than we feel to try and prove we're not inadequate after all. Toxic shame comes to us through several routes. The original wound can actually be that we were shamed. That can cause the original wound. But often it's not. Often it might just be a loss or an illness or something. You know, it doesn't have to be that there's overt hostility for us to pick up emotional trauma. Whatever happens, it seems that as humans we're desperate to try and understand why it happened, so we can learn from it and prevent it in the future. And it seems that our default setting is to think it must be me that it was at fault. I must be wrong for this to have happened. Toxic shame can actually come in really early and non-verbally. It can come in with infants. If an infant has a parent who, or caregivers who aren't attuned to them, who aren't sensitive to their needs, the infant develops this kind of unembodied, non-verbal, very kind of primitive sense of somehow being unworthy of being looked after and unworthy of love. And that then comes, you know, through into life. When we've got parts of ourselves that we deem make us liable to being traumatized again, we often shame those parts of ourselves in an attempt to disconnect them. You know, I'm stupid for having this need, or that's ridiculous to have that need. So we can shame ourselves and as part of trying to make ourselves safe, but that shame becomes part of who we are. Irrespective of its origins, we don't see toxic shame for what it is. It's woven into our identity, into our sense of who we are, and it distorts our relationship with ourselves. It's very hard to live with toxic shame, even if it is unconscious, and we're going to try to escape it. We strive for perfection, for power over ourselves. We self-criticize ourselves into trying to make ourselves better. It all just leads to more shame. Shame also distorts our relationship with other people. We're going to be desperate for their approval and at the same time terrified that if they get to know us, they'll see that we're fundamentally wrong in some way. In terms of the big picture, trauma worlds really are best thought of as systems that are designed to protect us. They're the best we can do at the time, but which ultimately injure us. Ultimately, they leave us relating to ourselves, leave us in a world, an internal world, a belief system, a way of thinking about ourselves and relating to ourselves that's abusive and neglectful. In time, we become our own traumatizers. And ultimately, trauma worlds are going to cause more pain than the original wounds did. The systems that make up trauma worlds are unconscious. It's hard to see them directly if you don't know what you're looking for. But they become evident in secondary symptoms. So they might be underlying depression and anxiety, a sense of having an unfulfilled potential, lack of meaning in our lives, feeling a bit like a fraud. Addiction also can be a result of having underlying trauma of trauma worlds, because we alter our mood in an attempt to get some respite. You know, those moments when our mood are altered, we'll be free of the fear and of the shame and of the disconnection. Of course, it comes back in spades afterwards in the morning. But we're so desperate, we'll take those moments of respite when we can. Unaware of that our trauma world is underlying these different conditions, we think that the symptom, the condition is the problem in and of itself, rather than seeing it as a symptom of deeper issues. That now brings me to the end of part one on trauma worlds. So I'm now going to move on to part two and on to healing. How do I define healing? Well, I'll begin with what healing is not. The initial hope when we start a process of therapy is that we'll be fixed. I turned up at my second therapy session with a list of the things about myself and my life that I wanted to sort out and never have to deal with again. I don't think I'm that unusual. We don't get fixed, at least not in that way. Healing is possible, but we need to let go of what we think healing is in order to open the door to healing. So if healing isn't getting fixed, what is it? Well, it's transforming our relationship with ourselves. It's building a relationship with ourselves that is, at its core, has consciousness, responsibility, and self-compassion, rather than fear, disconnection, and shame. At this point, we're moving into a different internal world. We're moving out of a trauma world and into what I'm calling a trusted world. And what I mean by a trusted world is that we trust on the inside, we trust ourselves. Our relationship to ourselves is built on trust. Building a trusted world doesn't mean that our trauma world disappears. The two exist in parallel. But as the trusted world becomes more deeply rooted, we spend more time in it. And when we do fall back into a trauma world, we're better able to recognize what's happening and to contain it, so we don't act it out and cause the same kind of damage. This may not sound like much compared to having everything fixed and sorted and never having to think about it again, but actually it's life-changing, it's rich and it's profound. It leads to a vibrancy that's unimaginable when our image of healing is solely that we get fixed. To move into a trusted world, we need to bring consciousness and responsibility and self-compassion to four aspects of our lives. First, the original wounds. Second, our trauma worlds. Third, the process of change itself. And fourth, our present day. In this talk, I'll speak mainly to the first two. But before I do that, I'll describe what I mean by consciousness, responsibility and self-compassion. And again, I'll go through them one by one because that's how language works. But that isn't how these dynamics work in a trusted world. Again, there's a triple helix, but a positive helix where the three interweave with each other to feed back and to kind of root and cement and expand our trusted world. Just before I do that, I need to say that in order to do this work, we have to have a therapeutic relationship with somebody or with a group of people who know trauma and its healing from inside their own experience. That's really crucial. But I'm not going to talk about why that is or expand on that because of the limits of time. So, the first element of a trusted world is consciousness. What do I mean by that? Well, obviously, it's been studied and looked at and approached from many angles in great depth over millennia by philosophers and people, religious people, spiritual leaders, and by neuroscientists. My take's pretty simple. I mean an awareness of the dynamics that operate in our inner world, an awareness and also an awareness of what's alive in us in this moment, in any one moment, and a kind of feeling it awareness, a sense of it. I mean that we understand ourselves. We see ourselves as clearly as possible rather than through the distorting lens of trauma. Curiosity and questioning are absolutely crucial to developing consciousness. We also, of course, have to be open to listening to answers, whether they come in a therapeutic session, from dreams, from artwork that we do, from something we read in a book, something we hear in a talk, or whether it's just when we're out on a run or in a shower. We have to be listening for the insights that come to us. They come in their own time and in their own place. The second element that makes up a trusted world is responsibility. Again, what do I mean by that? Well, the dictionary defines responsibility as answerable, accountable, trusted, trustworthy. If you break the word down into its constituent parts, you get able to respond. In a trauma world, we're able to respond to what's best in us, to our need for healing. We're able to respond to our wounds, to our trauma world in a trustworthy way. We're trustworthy in how we relate to ourselves and to others. Responsibility is a tricky concept because it gets conflated with blame. Blame says that we're wrong and it feeds toxic shame. Blame says, this is mine and it makes me crap and useless. Responsibility owns and acknowledges what's ours without judgment, but with understanding. And paradoxically, it combats toxic shame. Responsibility says, this is mine and I need to take care of it. Self-compassion is the third element that makes up a trusted world. Again, it's a phenomena that's been studied for millennia in incredible depth and richness. So my take on it is, again, relatively simple. And by it, I go back to the roots of the word. Compassion means to suffer with or to suffer together. And suffer, originally, if you go back to the meaning of the word, means to bear, to endure, to carry, to tolerate, to allow. Compassion actually, though, does imply a desire to alleviate suffering. It implies consolation, that we approach somebody who's in distress and respond to that distress in a respectful and kindly manner. When we're talking about transforming trauma worlds and building trusted worlds, what we really need to do is to suffer with ourselves. We need to approach and attend to our own distress in a respectful and kindly manner. And so we're talking fundamentally about self-compassion. That's the core. Out of it comes a genuine compassion for others, but we need to start with self-compassion. The other kind of angle on compassion that's really important from turning trauma worlds into trusted worlds is what I call fierce compassion, and is kind of more popularly called tough love. Fierce compassion suffers with our unlived potential. Fierce compassion fights for who we could be if only we could find a way to transform our trauma worlds. It's natural if we've got trauma and we're suffering to want to change, to want healing. But actually what we're far less aware of, that it's also natural to be very scared of the change and of healing. there's going to be unconscious fear about letting go of the old systems, the systems that helped us to survive when we were so vulnerable. There's also going to be unconscious fear about the change itself. What's it going to mean for our lives? We know what living in a trauma world is. What would it be like to live in a trusted world? What are we going to have to leave behind to get to a trusted world? What are we going to have to let go of? Fierce compassion inspires and pushes us onwards when the fear gets too much, when it threatens the healing process. Fierce compassion encourages us to walk forward. So now I'm going to apply or talk about how I see consciousness and responsibility and self-compassion speaking and addressing our original wounds and also actually the associated feelings that go with them, that fear and the pain that we annexed. First, and perhaps most obviously, we have to become aware of the unhealed wounds that we carry and, as importantly, how they influence our lives today. We'll have cut off from them to some degree. We might know they happen, but we won't have clocked their emotional impact. We won't have clocked their severity. We'll have minimised them, invalidated them, if we know about them at all, if they're not so kind of hived off in our unconscious that we can't see them. But the fact that we don't know that we carry these wounds, that we don't recognise that impact, doesn't mean they're not having an impact on us. I spent what I think is probably 20, maybe even 30 years with a ruptured anterior cruciate ligament, not knowing it was ruptured. But that didn't stop it from affecting how I used my body. It didn't stop me from locking out my knee, from twisting slightly in order to compensate for the fact that my knee wasn't stable because I had that rupture. And to actually be able to make any difference to my back, I had to find out that I had a problem with the knee, because I had to work with that before other things could change. It's the same when we heal emotional wounds. We need to be aware of what we carry. We need to know what we need to address. We also need, you know, to open. It's like if we've got an unhealed wound we haven't addressed, it's like we've got this black box inside of us. And with that, it's impossible to trust ourselves, to have a trusted relationship with ourselves, because we're not aware of what we carry. To heal, we don't only need a kind of cognitive consciousness of what we carry, we also need an embodied consciousness. And an embodied consciousness also has huge overlap with self-compassion. But let me try and differentiate the two types of consciousness. With cognitive consciousness, we stand outside and look. So we say, you know, if I go back to my knee, we might say, I see how the ruptured anterior cruciate ligament left me locking out my knee and how that had a knock-on effect on my back. And that's a really valuable first step. I needed to know that before I could do anything else. An embodied consciousness, though, stands inside what's happening and feels it. So it says, I feel I'm locking my knee now and how that changes my posture and the strain that puts. It's much harder to come by. It's taken me years and years of yoga to develop that awareness. And I, you know, can still lose it very easily. But an embodied consciousness is feeling from the inside. So how that looks with emotions is that part of us is allowed to live whatever the feeling is that we're living. And there's some part of us that stands aside and is aware of what we're living. There's a mindfulness of what we're living in parallel, that holds in parallel to what we're actually living. And when we bring that to looking at our original wounds, the ones that left us with trauma, that instigated trauma, what we need to do is we need to feel the fear and the pain that was embedded in those wounds, but that we never connected to at the time. And we need to accept it and to respect it, not to belittle it, not to fight against it, but not to be swept away by it. When we don't know it's there, we tend to get swept away by it. We need to be able to recognise it, feel it, and to be able to hold it. So let me give you an example of what this looks like. Hopefully it might make it a bit easier to get a sense of what I'm talking about. A couple of years, somebody that I relied on in a professional sphere was moving on. There's somebody I'd worked with for many, many years and who I trusted, but it was a professional relationship. I was upset, I was sad they were going on. That made a lot of sense to me. But I was far more upset and frightened than actually made sense. I didn't sleep for days, I couldn't work, the world out there all became a bit unreal. I was, you know, very, very kind of wound up. I could feel the adrenaline. I was aware, you know, and I was sort of aware that it was an overreaction, but it was so swept through me, it so had control of me that I couldn't really step outside it, at least not to start with. And that's what happens when our old fears come through. We are captured by them to start with. But if we've worked to develop an embodied consciousness, what happens that is that at some point, this time it was a couple of days, I started to think, you know, I bet this pain and fear, the extent of it, the intensity of it, it's not just to do with this person moving on. You know, this will be what I felt as a young child when I lost somebody who was terribly important to me. This pain and fear that I'm feeling now is being kind of exacerbated. It's being supercharged by old feelings of pain and fear that have been reawoken because this feels like a vaguely similar situation. And once I could sense that, once I could connect to that, I then was able to allow the feelings of my younger self to be. And actually, I ended up curled up in the corner of a room and, you know, trying to console myself and just to hold them and to validate those feelings, to validate how frightened and scared I was as a young child with this loss. And what that meant was that, firstly, after a few hours, the pain and the fear eased. It settled. It had been kind of acknowledged. It had been allowed to move through. And also it meant that in relation to this person who was moving on in my professional life, I didn't act it out. I didn't come from that place of behave in fear and kind of, you know, criticise or attack or go cold and distant. I could respond appropriately. Learning to do this takes time. It requires patience. Part of the reason why is because, you know, we start off, we cut off from those pain and fear really early on, right at the outset. And we're so cut off, it's been so long, it's impossible or it's very, very difficult to reconnect, let alone to allow those feelings to actually the freedom to be and to move through us. With regards to that loss I had as a young child, I talked about it early in therapy, but it took me months to actually open to the feelings. I'd be talking about it and my therapist would say to me, you know, how does that make you feel? And I'd say, oh, well, I think X and Y. He'd say, no, I'm not asking you what you're thinking. I'm asking you what you're feeling. And I'd say, well, I think X and Y. And he said, no, that's feelings and thinking are different. What do you feel when you talk about that, when you remember that? And I just didn't get his question. I didn't understand what he was asking. It took me 6 months of this for me to be able to say, I don't know what I feel. And it took many, many more months before I started to be able to open and be conscious of those feelings. We have to be kind to ourselves. We have to be patient. We have to be generous in allowing ourselves time. But in time, we do develop an embodied consciousness. And as we do, it transforms our relationship with ourselves. First, when we can turn towards our pain and fear and hold them in a consoling and kind way, it changes the texture. It doesn't discharge them. They've been written into our memory, but it does take the charge out of them. When we're kinder to these emotions, they're kinder to us. They move through us more easily. Second, it gives us greater discernment when they're triggered. When they're triggered, we can recognize what they are. We're more able to hold them. We're more able to take responsibility, not to act on them. And once that happens, we're no longer so frightened of these, you know, there's no longer that unconscious fear that says, don't go through near X and Y. It might reawaken those feelings. Don't step off this pavement. Don't step off that pavement. It's no longer got the power because actually we know that it's okay. We can be with these feelings And so we can step off more pavements and our lives open and we can be much more spontaneous. We similarly need to bring consciousness and responsibility and self-compassion to our trauma worlds, not just to our original wounds, but to the trauma worlds that were created around them. We need to sense and see and feel our way into that system to get to know it for what it is. We also need to feel and sense our way into the fear and the disconnection and the toxic shame that are the component parts of that system. We need to know them for what they are. We need to be able to recognize when they arise in us today, to sense, to feel, to know what that is when that's going through our body. We need to recognize and know how they play out in us, how we react to ourselves and to other people when they're alive, when they're at their kind of most toxic. We need to recognize and feel how our trauma world was created inside of us by our own unconscious body and mind, albeit in response to the external world. We need to develop a sense, a feel, a kind of texture of the protection that our trauma world offered us, feel gratitude for that protection, understand that we couldn't have done anything differently back then, that we were doing our best. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge the secondary harm that our trauma worlds created. We have to feel our way into how a side effect of that protection that came from fear and disconnection and shame was that we became our own traumatizers, that we lost opportunities, that we hurt ourselves, that we hurt other people. It's hard to be that honest with ourselves for many reasons. One of the main ones is it brings up a whole load of grief and regret. You know, we have to sit with what we lost because of our trauma world. That is not easy. It's also hard because we develop a fear of ourselves. I remember when it clicked into place for me in 2006. I'd been working with it anyway, but when it kind of, the first seeds became truly conscious, I was reading a book by a Jungian analyst called Donald Kalshed, and I suddenly got a sense of this internal system that protects us, but also causes us such damage. And following that, I spent 6 months with kind of raw fear of myself. I was frightened. Once I knew the potential, recognized the potential of my trauma world, I became really frightened of the damage that I could do, that it could do when it was being acted out in its kind of most intense way. These days, I live mostly in a trusted world, but I fall back into a trauma world from time to time. When somebody that's important to me moves on or whatever it is, I think I always will. I think if we carry trauma, we're always going to have that. And I am still, and the thing I hate most about being back in that place is the fear that I now have, because I know what I can do in that place, because I know how destructive I am in that place. And there's wisdom in that fear. I can be very destructive. I can harm people I care about. I can harm, you know, close down opportunities to myself in that place. It's difficult to face that. So really developing this embodied consciousness of our trauma worlds requires courage, and it requires commitment and support and encouragement. But it does bring profound gifts. We become much more connected to the dynamics, to, you know, these particular dynamics. There's obviously other dynamics happening within us, but to the kind of trauma-related dynamics that are operating within us. And with that greater self-honesty comes greater self-respect. We feel increasingly seen and understood and accepted by ourselves. The trauma world actually loses its power. It's no longer unquestioned. It's no longer the normality. We see it as a trauma world. We're also better able to recognize and to contain the trauma world when we fall back into it. We have our trauma world. We have the fear, the dissociation, and the shame, rather than those dynamics having us. In effect, we become a kind of self-compassionate and responsible custodian for our trauma world. We can say, this is mine. It emerged inside of me in response to my wounds, and I will take care of it. I will do my best to take care of it. And that brings a great sense of inner integrity, of grace, and of dignity. It also opens the door again to us trusting ourselves. So coming to the conclusion, there is no fast track from a trauma world into a trusted world. It's a series of messy steps. We take a small step forward and then a big step forward and then a small step back and a medium step forward. And then we go down one side track and then another side track. And then we step forward and back again. It's not a kind of nice linear, follow these steps and you'll get there. And it kind of happens in a rather jumbled, emergent kind of fashion. But a trusted world is not all or nothing. Each step forward that we take makes a difference. With each step forward that we take, our life opens up. We step off more pavements. We live more of our potential. We start to thrive. With each step forward that we take, there's greater fulfillment and meaning in our life. There's less fear. There's more spontaneity, more vibrancy, more joy. There's a greater sense of contentment, of ease and of grace. With each step, we transform our relationship with ourselves. Sometimes we barely notice that transformation as it's happening because the steps, the increments are so small. I mean, sometimes they're big and we go, oh, wow. But often it's just a series of very tiny, tiny increments that we don't necessarily notice at the time. But at some point, we kind of take stock and look back. And when we contrast how our life is now with how it used to be, that difference is profound. We see that we've now come to actually understand and accept and respect ourselves. I remember I got to a place where I went, gosh, I really like living with the person who I am today. That was kind of, you know, monumental. But it had taken years and been a whole series of small steps for me to get there. But the kind of bottom line is, as we build a trusted world, we become valued and welcome companions to ourselves and actually also to others as we travel throughout our life. Thank you very much.
Oh, Daniela, thank you so much. I don't know if you can see from your phone, there are over 200 of us with you right now. And if you were able to see anything in the chat, the words coming through were deep and it brought clarity. Some people said even triggering. And I want to say as well that your introspection muscles are strong. You have very good presence. Very, very good. Were you able to follow any questions?
Yes, if I looked at the questions, I lost all the picture. So because I didn't want to get to not know where people were, I had a very brief look at a couple of questions. They kind of, when I looked at them properly. So if, rather than lose it again now, if there's time and you want to pose questions, it might be better if they filter through you, because I think if I go to them, I'll lose. I've never done it on a phone before.
Yes, I'll just read a few questions to you.
Well, whichever one you think of, you know, which would be best to answer.
Okay, very good. The first question actually was, can you speak about trauma, like fear, dissociation, and shame, in the context of imposter syndrome? I find a common block to acknowledging trauma is the idea that what happened to me was not as bad as what should justify a trauma. Therefore, I shouldn't or couldn't have trauma.
I absolutely identify with that. You know, on many levels, I had a great childhood, and it's very, very difficult to validate. And actually, it's always very difficult to validate. I mean, because once the way we get through the childhood is to say, oh, you know, it's not that bad. I have to keep going. I think It's very difficult. I mean, for me, trauma in terms of imposter syndrome, yes, when we're full of shame and there's some kind of core sense of being fundamentally inadequate, even if we're not conscious of that, we're going to feel like an imposter when we go into a situation. How we recognize that, we kind of don't until it gets to be so bad that we go, okay, I can't deal with this imposter. You know, I really want to be doing X and Y in my life, and this is too getting in the way. Let me go and try and work with it, and then hope what's underneath it, for, you know, the element of imposter system. And then I would think the other side of imposter system is that because we're, you know, if we're acting out of a trauma world and we've cut off various real parts of ourselves, it may be that we're doing something that isn't real for us to be doing. So actually we feel like an imposter because somewhere deep inside of us, we know that's not authentic. And so I think if we're going to work with that in ourselves, we need to try and differentiate between the two. Do I feel like an imposter here because that's genuinely not authentic, that's coming out of a trauma world? Or is this an authentic thing for me to be doing, but the shame that I carry is making me feel inadequate whatever world I go into? But, you know, we need other people to help us get to those questions. When we're in it, we just can't step outside it.
That's a very good answer, Daniela. Thank you. And I hope that that answered our question. I apologize. We do not have time to take more questions live. However, we would like everyone to continue this conversation. We're dropping all the links into the chat for how to continue with Daniela, as well as how to continue with us in the coffee shop. Also, I felt like there was so many concepts that I had to just feel. And so the replay will be available for 48 hours for everyone to watch for free. And then of course, this session and this library of talks is unmatched to anything I've ever seen. If you are interested in the library, please remember that the price doubles after the conference. And so you can plan accordingly. Also, one more note for anyone who works in trauma, we have a special discount for you. Please reach out to us about that. And we have one moment left, Daniela, and I'd like you to wrap us up with your final tip on how we can live life embodied.
We have to keep being curious and keep questioning. I think, you know, emotional trauma leaves us relating to ourselves in this distorted way through fear and dissociation and shame. And we heal by learning to relate to ourselves through consciousness and responsibility and self-compassion. And to get there is just curiosity. Does this feel right? This doesn't feel quite right. Let me try and explore that. And having people that we can explore with, for me, has been fundamentally important.
That is beautiful. Again, very insightful. Thank you, Daniela. Thank you, everyone, for being here. We'll see you very soon.
Thank you very much for putting up with me on a country lane.